Hello, listeners. I'm Amanda.
I'm Jamia.
I'm Jamila.
And we are Live Voices. Hear from librarians of color what speaks to the fullness of their careers, including successes and challenges. How do they do it? Join us to find out more about their Live Voices.
Welcome to episode 4. Today we have an interview with Joyce Gabbiola.
Joyce, pronouns they, them, is the brand spanking new head archivist of Lambda Archives of San Diego, a community-driven organization that preserves and shares LGBTQ plus history. They co-created and are an inaugural editor for Uproot, a new publication media space for Black, Indigenous, and persons of color to share research and meditations on knowledge, systems, experiences, and or ways of being associated with libraries, archives, and other information environments. Partnered with We Here, Uproot is an intervention that endeavors to unapologetically center and uplift the works of BIPOC exclusively. Lastly, Joyce would like to take this moment to give a shout out to their beautiful baby, Evan. Your laughter brings never-ending joy, even during a pandemic.
What drew you to archival work?
Initially, I'd say I was drawn to the idea of archives rather than archival work. But as I continued to study and learn about archives alongside reading and learning firsthand about the institutionalized performative concept of diversity and inclusion, I came to understand that the nature of archives is violent. So if we consider the predominantly oppressive ways of doing archival work that we are taught in graduate school, institutional archives are about ownership and elitism and erasure, misrepresentation and underrepresentation, commodification and objectification, and upholding and building upon the ideals of white supremacy. So, I'd say, like a lot of emerging and seasoned archival workers, I was drawn to archives because I appreciated aged materials, right, that like connect us directly to history. But then I was drawn to archival work to specifically counter erasure and underrepresentation of communities of color and LGBTQ communities. And as I continued my studies about community archives in a PhD program, I came to understand that there's much more to archival representation than what we can see. And so ultimately, I'm drawn to archival work to specifically intervene in the ways that white supremacy controls archives.
So as a BIPOC archivist, what do you view as critical to the success of the field?
That's a really tough question, because surely there are countless ways that would contribute to the success of the field, however any of us may define the success of the field. But, and I know this may sound weird, but I can't really care about the success of the field because it's it's predominantly white and predominantly oppressive. So if anything, I'm like, what is critical in general to the field is the extent to which Black, Indigenous, and folks of color navigate the archives field without experiencing harm. And this involves the folks who are documented in archival collections, alongside archives workers and students, and educators, visitors, and donors. And relevant to this, what's critical are the ways BIPOC are supported in advancing their goals relevant to the field, as well as assuming prominent leadership roles throughout the field. Most recently, in last year, the Society of American Archivists, the elected positions were all taken by, all but one, were taken by BIPOC. And it was amazing to see when that announcement came out, to just see it's just like fully BIPOC faces, but all but one. And the one was the president. And it's just kind of like, okay. I mean, we're kind of there, yes, representation. And all these folks who were voted were doing such great work, so important. It's just, it was great to see. But it was also an interesting visualization of, you know, the fact that the leader of the organization is a white woman. But, you know, it's, we're working. We're getting there. So I'd say, really, when I think about at least, you know, the critical, what's critical to the success of the field is really like, what is critical to the success of BIPOC?
That's good.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then also when you're talking about, you know, the elected officials and how there's still a white woman who's president, I mean, it's not, obviously it's not really surprising. And it's almost like, okay, this is what has always been happening. So it's not a surprise at all, but it does spotlight, you know, it does shine a spotlight on what needs to change. And there definitely is change, right? So there's both this like aspect of we are making progress. And then there's like this other part of it where it's like, you know, we still need to take that top position as well. So
yes.
Yeah, that's pretty interesting. And to really look at and kind of, you know, kind of a visual representation of what we're doing and what we still need to do.
Right. Yeah, and you know, the current president, but the president before is Dr. Meredith Evans, who was a mentor to me when I was part of one of my diversity scholarships with the Association of Research Libraries. And she's just strong Black woman who's just, I'm like, just she's full of life. And it's just like, you know, yes, you know, seeing, you know, her being the president of the Society of American Archivists, you know, and just being able to be part of, to work under her leadership was just an awesome experience. And, you know, that was really, I mean, it was important. So it was just, so, you know, it does happen, but I mean, the fact that this particular, the officers and this round or whatever, it was just such an interesting visual to see this, like, mostly, you know, BIPOC and then, yeah, the leader's a white person. But anyway, I mean, I will also mention that actually the nominating committee, you know, like, selected the folks to run. So they were vetted and they were approved by whoever was higher up than them. And so, I mean, you know, full disclosure, I was one of those. I was one of those people. So,
that's great. That's great.
Yeah. And so I was like, okay, I'll do this. Yeah, let's do it. But what happened was it was me and the woman who won, Courtney, who is, you know, if I'm going to vote, you know, between, you know, for one of the like white archivists out there, yes, I would vote for Courtney. But what happened was it was just me and Courtney, but apparently there was a petition. There was a petition that was submitted, and basically folks were dissatisfied with the two candidates for the presidency, and so a petition was submitted to add a third candidate, who is an older white woman, you know, and with more experience, or, you know, she's held a lot of positions within the Society of American Archivists, et cetera, et cetera. So it's just really odd, though, you know, to kind of like, well, I thought that you, as a society, you value diversity, or, you know, you really want to go, really want to advance in this area. And, you know, we know, we are in like these predominantly like white spaces, but it was like, here I am, you know, and it's like, you know what I can do, And it's like, it didn't go that way, but it was really interesting because Courtney, you know, has a significant amount of experience. But they weren't satisfied with that too. So it's like, it's also this intergenerational weird thing that's happening too. So it's like, all right. But anyway, I'm kind of glad I didn't get it because it's too much to be like taking on right now. Oh, woo! Thank you.
Yes. there is a lot happening, and also that what you said about the intergenerational thing is, I think, it's something we don't talk about a lot. But so, I'm glad you highlighted that because that is still a thing. I think it's more so with archivists than you'll see like with librarians actually. For whatever reason.
I don't know about that one, Jamila.
You don't think?
I don't know about that one. Because some people, they want your whole CV. They want a reference letter before they even have a conversation with you. Like, if you are, you know, look younger, you know, it's a whole thing. So, yeah.
I think it still happens in libraries. Yeah. I just think it's more extreme.
More in archival uh-huh. world.
Well, I mean, I don't know, maybe, and that's just, I'm just voicing, you know, just kind of my perception on it.
Yeah.
And, I don't know that that's, you know, can't back it up with statistics or anything like that.
I know, where's the data? Where's, no, I'm kidding. You don't need the data. but it's true, though, we don't talk about it.
You were archivist, yeah. Positions and that kind of thing.
Yeah, that's true.
So to me, it feels like it's more... like there's more gatekeeping happening and even more, you know, so within, you know, archives than libraries, but not to negate the fact that it's happening throughout, you mm-hmm. know, but yeah, mm-hmm. it's just an interesting thing, you know, to really like kind of delve into. Somebody out there will start researching.
I know. They might give us the data, like, or it might not be data. It might be an area of you know, opportunity for research, yes. As I like to tell students when they can find things.
All right. I'm going to write a paper. Last thing they want to hear.
Yeah. Like, it's an opportunity for you to do research. Like, you know. So let me ask you the next question. How do you promote equitable practices through your work in the archives?
Yeah, sure. So, I just started a job as the head archivist at Lambda Archives of San Diego. I started mid-August, and so super new, but I can go ahead and like share like some of the things that I think I've already done to promote equitable practices. First, I think one way to promote equitable practices is through hiring. And at the archives, we're looking to hire a couple of folks for a digitization project. And it's a grant-funded project. And so the job description and the qualifications were already written, you know, before I joined the archives, but I was able to revise them to include, under ideal qualifications, experiential knowledge of LGBTQ plus communities rather than just like an educational background in like LGBTQ studies or gender studies. And in addition, I'm also looking for a developed understanding of structural oppression and the ability to recognize the ways it manifests for the project manager. And so by comparison, I think that in institutional archives would simply write something along the lines of a commitment to diversity and inclusion. And I don't even know what that means. What does that entail? What does that look like? You know, and what does that commitment serve? And so I hope that wording it in this way, you know, would show potential or convey to potential applicants that, you know, at least the archives, which is really just me right now, we have an eye on the ways that structural oppression manifests in archives. and that the job will entail, you know, I guess that aspect of archives. Another way to promote equitable practices is through archival description. And so as part of the digitization project, I'll be requiring that the project team become familiar with homosaurus.com, which is a linked vocabulary for LGBTQ plus subjects. And also the archives for Black Lives in Philadelphia's anti-racist resource description. And so as part of, you know, when we come across the point of applying metadata and describing these materials, you know, we're going to do it in a way that's anti-racist and anti-oppressive. That's it. It's intentional. There's no such thing as neutrality. So these are the resources that we have. And we're going to use them. And I think that there's another way to, what else is important for archives workers to promote equitable practices is actually to create and sustain an equitable physical environment. So, you know, to what extent are folks, can folks access and feel safe in the physical environment? You know, will they be misgendered? Who is surveilling them and how are they surveilling them? What information are you requiring folks to give you? You know, just, and so it's just being, I'm gonna be really intentional about those, I'm not even calling them policies, but I'm calling them guidelines. So it's just making that space accessible and equitable. Part of this too is what are our holdings? So it goes back to representation. And you know, one of my priorities, or if the priority is, the priority is to interrupt, again, the predominant white space and prioritize communities of color within the LGBTQ community in San Diego, Northern Baja California, and the Imperial County region. And so that's part of creating an equitable practice but space. The thing about archival representation, though, is that it's complicated. It's not simply, I see myself, or I see, an idea of a representation of myself. How are these folks? How are human subjects described in the archives? And so that's where those two resources come in. But society is always changing, right? So there has to be some way where archivists can perpetually, reflect on what's happening in society, but also then reflect that change in the archives. I mean, yes, it's a cycle. It's something that needs to happen all the time. But I mean, that's how archives should be. It's not just simply, this is how it was back in the 40s, and that's what we're going to stick with because that's history. But your history involved erasing people and describing people in a way that is going through your white cis lens. That just does not make sense to me. But anyway, so that's a few ways to promote equitable practices. I'll also add that as co-chair of the program committee, along with Rachel Winston, who is awesome, an archivist at UT Austin, we did the program committee for the SAA annual meeting, and I guess in 2019. And we were really intentional about what we wrote with our calls for proposals, and also how we evaluated proposals. And so that's another way, you know, as an archivist, if you're doing committee work, you know, who are you looking at the at proposals that will sort of place someone in a vulnerable position? If you're talking about perhaps your lived experience at your institution, and will it make you vulnerable? Like, you're willing to do that. Like, that, that's something that shouldn't be, you know, erased or discarded as something as simple as like, oh, well, this person is going to, you know, is going to present on something that is innovative and all about technology. So we have to just, you know, definitely get this person through. But, you know, we've already heard about people talking about diversity or, you know, white supremacy. So we don't need to ever do that again. Like, there's just, as there intentional ways of thinking of evaluating proposals to, you know, to accept certain proposals, certain folks to present and give them the stage. And so, yes, so that was one, that's another way that archivists can promote equitable practices in their work.
That's good. I like that you brought it full circle with, you know, association involvement as well, because that's important too, not just doing things like they always have been done, you know, trying to think outside of the box and seeing who we have left behind in the past and who we haven't heard from because of these criteria that we create and, you know, question everything. So I like that.
Yeah, good. Question everything.
Yes.
I love how you kind of, you know, spotlight intentionality and how that is kind of like a guiding practice for what you're doing in all of the different kinds of areas, you know. I think that's definitely very important, is, you know, how you're conceiving it, what your purpose is, how you're trying to, you know, push things forward in the different areas that you might be involved in. And then also just listening to those descriptions for the job posting, those are great. You know, like, I was like, oh my God, I need to write these down. Like, I don't know if I'll mission where I'll need to do a job description, but I was just thinking like, yeah, I need to find whatever you wrote and or maybe pass it out to people. Like, if do you do job descriptions? Because you need to take a look at this. You know, like, seriously. So those are great. Yeah.
Cool. Thank you.
So let's chat about your new publication, Uproot. Can you tell us more about the process of creating it and structuring it?
Yeah, sure. Definitely. But first, I'd like to plug in our first piece that we've just published. It's titled The Displays on Anti-Racist Study and Institutional Enclosure. And it was written by David James Hudson. It's a very timely reading about the upsurge of studying anti-racism, actually, and like reading lists on anti-racism. So yeah. So as far as how it was created and how it was structured, it was created because Sophia Lung, Jorge Ricardo Lopez McKnight, and I are the inaugural editors for it. And so Sophia contacted Jenny Ferretti, who is, you know, the founder of We Here. And I also contacted Jenny, but separately. We didn't know we were both contacting Jenny about a publication such as Uproot. So that's what happened. And so we actually, Jenny contacted both of us, and we came together along with Jorge and the other We Here admins to talk about a potential publication. And it was really important, you know, from my perspective, it was really important to be and to do this work and be in community with others. And when I say be in community, I mean sort of taking care of each other, basically. You know, it's not just about, you know, writing, creating this article or creative work and then publishing it and then putting it on your CV. That's the thing with uproot is, you know, our intention is basically to uproot knowledge, the way that we were taught, that we've been taught. This is the only type of way to publish. This is the formats that we can use. And these are the people that you need to cite. And if you're not citing the canon, which of course, again, is all basically like white old dudes, then it's not valid, you know, and, you know, BS on that. So we're asking folks to exclusively cite and build upon the work of BIPOC. That is it. And, you know, yes, we did have that little part where we say, you know, if you feel like you need to cite someone who isn't by BIPOC, then, you know, let us know why, but let us know for each citation. And not only are we focusing on the work of BIPOC, we're asking folks then to think about, think about why. Why am I insisting on citing this person that isn't by BIPOC? What would make it stronger? You know, does it make it stronger? Does it need to be there? It's a different way of publishing. It's a different way of writing, and it's a different way of being in community with each other and caring about what we're creating. What we're trying to do also is, you know, we all came at this for different reasons. But I think part of like all of our reasons is our experience with academic publishing. I will say that while I was a PhD student, one of the questions I had for one of my professors was around accessibility. Scholarly articles are just inaccessible. They're just, sometimes you just absolutely do not know what someone's saying. That was a concern of mine, and the response from the professor was, well, then you just have to write two articles. And I'm like, how do I have time to write two articles? It's like, I have to navigate your like harmful, toxic environment, and now you want me to write two articles? Like, no. Like, why can't I just write one? That doesn't make sense. And so I've come to understand that really, academic publishing really is purposefully, I don't know, maybe I'm just like late to the game, but purposefully divisive, or I don't know if that's the right word, but it's like, this is academic publishing. You don't need to, you don't need to access this. This is not for you. So it's elitist. And I'm like, do I want to be part of this world? Like, if this is what's required of me, I don't know. And the fact that there are certain languages, like epistemology and ontology, I'm like, why do we have to use these words? We don't, but we have to use them because y'all are saying that we have to, like, that's it. That is my perspective of it. But also, it's just the way that the process that you have to go, that you have to follow in order to publish something in a scholarly journal. And we're not saying that we're not open to publishing work that are structured by like known humanities or social science structures, but we're just doing it, the process of it is just different. In fact, David James Hudson's article that you, the first piece that we just published is, I know that there are some professors who actually are, you know, really drawn to his work, it's just not this particular article, but like, he has some works out there that are really, are just amazing. There's one in the book, topographies of whiteness. It's a good one. But anyway, so we just want, with Uproot, the name of it, you know, up, it's like advancing, and you know, root, we're trying to get at the root of things and not at a, you know, surface level, but like down deep. But it's, you know, also just the one word, uproot, we're trying to intervene in the way that, in the ways that we're taught to, you know, write knowledge, learn knowledge, advance knowledge, and we're open to like ways, creative ways of doing that too. And that's the thing, it's like down to the format, like, you know, if you want, it may seem like an insignificant detail, but if you want your article in a particular font, it's like, we're open to that. It doesn't have to look, it doesn't all have to be uniform. Also, if you want to do something that's mixed media, or if you, you know, it's just basically, what do you envision? We're guided by how folks are envisioning their own work. And, you know, with what we have, you know, what our capacity is, can we support that vision? You know, versus this is the format that we have to follow, you know, in order to be seen as legitimate, right? Like, this is not legitimate knowledge. And we're like, kind of like fighting against that. So actually, the data that everyone else, particularly in regards to like social justice research, diversity research, research on white supremacy in libraries, it requires the labor that we've seen. There are a lot of articles out there, but it's requiring the labor of being asked these questions of BIPOC for folks to understand. And so then particularly white academics are taking that data and writing and advancing their careers. So it's just it's just an awful capitalist way of creating, advancing knowledge. And we want to support the BIPOC in their work. It's like, it's, no one else matters. Like, it's this, we are the authority on our experiences and our perspectives. And yes, BIPOC, we are not monoliths, but the ways that we're taught and the ways that are presented to us as to like how we can create an advanced knowledge is it just doesn't speak to at least me, Sophia, and Jorge, like perhaps a whole bunch of other BIPOC folks. So, and we're just, you know, we just want to support in advance the work of BIPOC folks.
That's good. Yeah, I read the first your first article, and it really really resonated with me. Yeah, especially the I guess I won't say what resonated with me because I'll give it away, but it really resonated with me, and it was like taking the words right out of my mouth and my mind. And I was like, yes, 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 throughout the whole thing. So I'm excited. I'm happy for the next submissions that will be coming through. I'm excited.
Yes. Hey, good.
Yes, I have to agree with that sentiment. I'm excited as well for what's to come. And just like hearing you talk about it, it's, I love the subversiveness of Uproot, and you know, in hearing the story and how that, you know, also the you know, description about the name itself and all of that, it just is, I love it. Resistance, you know.
Yes.
So yeah, that's great, and I'm also looking forward to reading more of what is coming out through Uproot. What are your thoughts on community archives and how the work there differs from what you're doing, from what is done in mainstream archival institutions?
Very good question. So as the only employee at Lambda Archives of San Diego, I report to the board of directors. So that's, you know, that's one aspect that's that differs from a mainstream archival institution. Also, directly, I'm working with the board president. Basically, we meet, we do check-ins, and, you know, we sort of like, she's the person I talk to get, you know, get things going, and I'm like learning about the organization, the collections, and the community. And so the difference, I think the main difference between community archives, and I'll say that a lot of times in archival literature, it's described as like community-based archives. We've definitely talked about this with, you know, our fellow research team about like, do community archives consider or call themselves a community archive? Like, you know, do they just call themselves an archives? Like, so, we just wonder, like, is a community-based archives, is that term actually an academic term? But anyway, so I have recently started to describe Lambda Archives as a community-empowered/powered archives, because that's exactly what it is. Since 1987, it was founded in 1987, and it is completely 100% powered by the community. And community-based or community-powered archives tend to be, just a lot smaller as far as the funding. But somehow, Lambda Archives has like thrived, and you know is located in it's a small area. It's part of the Diversionary Theater. In San Diego, but it's big enough, you know. It's a nice, like, quaint community space. But what I'm finding is that, first of all, I'm in this new capacity where I'm the boss. I mean, the boss of myself, because there isn't anyone else around, right? But but I also have this like teeny bit of power that I'm like don't know what to do with. I'm like, what? So new to me, I don't know, but I'm sure I'll find something to do with it. That's why the job description is the way it is. The one of the ways that community empowered archives and mainstream archival institutions differ is that we don't have institutional policies to follow. And institutional policies can be a total damper on what archives collect, how they collect, who they, you know, of whom, and also how are they described. So there's there seems to be more freedom in how we get to do things in terms of archives. One of the other things with, at least my experience with mainstream archival institutions, at least in the spaces that I've been in, I mean, it's predominantly, again, like white, collections of white folks. And so actually Lambda Archives is the same, but it needs to, you know, I'm making moves towards, like I said before, prioritizing communities of color. And the interesting thing though about being in this capacity though, is sometimes folks, and I've this came up as when I was researching at in my PhD program, that just because there's an absence, and we usually refer to it as an erasure of certain folks, certain groups in archives. One of the reasons out there is because folks don't trust institutional archives and institutional archivists, and rightfully so. Even though I am part of the LGBTQ community in San Diego, I wouldn't say that I'm of the community. I just got here. And so it's like, I'm here to work with the community, but I know I'm a stranger and I have to earn your trust. So even being part of the community, you have to earn your trust. So someone that's an archivist in an institution, I mean, they really need to earn your trust, because I mean, once it's, to what extent are folks who are part of communities that are marginalized, to what extent will they still have power over their materials, control over their materials once it's in an institution? So perhaps it's, it varies. Perhaps there are institutions that have robust relationships with, certain communities. I'd love to hear about them. So with community archives, and so that's the thing too, is that institutions definitely have much more, funding and much larger staff usually. At least with Lambda Archives San Diego, there are folks who are just so passionate about the local history it's the reason why it has survived and why it thrives. But like I said, my priority is to, earn the trust of the community, but also prioritize folks of color. And if that means helping folks to preserve their materials and keep it in their homes, because they don't trust, any organization to maintain it, so be it. But I'm still gonna help you, in ways that I can, so that you can preserve it in a way, in a place that you want to. So again, being guided by the community rather than being guided by the field. I think there's more freedom in a community empowered archives than there is in mainstream archival institutions.
That's what it sounds like. Because to tell someone, you know what, keep it where you have it, I'm just going to show you how to preserve it, is definitely not what they like to do. Okay, so that is great. I love it.
But yeah, I think that there should be more of that, and they should share resources and provide trainings and that kind of thing for community archivists who are not trained archivists. To be able to share resources with some of these people, instead of it just being like, I want to take what you have because we can do it better, but not necessarily, right? So I would like to see more of that myself. And then when you were talking about I think there are some examples of some mainstream institutions. I saw a presentation not too long ago from some archivists at, I think it's University of Florida, who are working with Latinx archives, but those people were actually, they themselves were Latinx as well, so they were they're working in the mainstream institution as BIPOC archivists. And so I think in those situations you see some of what the mainstream is doing that is beneficial for the community. And not to say that you have to be a BIPOC professional in order to do that work, but I would say that usually typically when you see it being done really well, it is because you have you know, those kinds of people working within the mainstream, and kind of like working within, kind of resisting within that institution, right? So I think there are some examples, but, you know, again, like you said, you know, there aren't that many, as you hinted at.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely when you, definitely there are initiatives. Specifically, I think of Project Stand, which was created by, or the concept of it, created by Lyle Hughes Watkins. And just, it's basically documenting student protests on campus. And she, it's like become, I believe they got a grant, like a large grant. They've had like these different symposiums at institutions across the US. And so that work is like, yeah, that's amazing. And so, yeah, there are definitely instances. And, you know, there are, and also Lambda Archives, actually, there are two of our board members are archivists at San Diego State. And so they are actually helping. They help like train, like their part of the project will be to train one of the assistants in our on the project team, because they will be maintaining some of the like digital collections for Lambda Archives. So there is that partnership. So yeah, they are sharing their resources, as you mentioned, and yeah, so that they do exist.
Yeah, I just want to shout out to Lael because she's doing great work.
She is. I love her.
So that concludes the questions that we have for you. I think this has been great.
Yes, it's been real good. I learned a lot. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
And your wisdom.
Yeah. And for taking time to just talk with us. And It's been great.
Yes. Thank you both, and thank you to Amanda as well.
We hope you learned more about Joyce Gabbiola. We'd like to share a quote with you before we sign off.
Nobody promised you tomorrow. Marsha P. Johnson.
Remember to keep walking in your lived voices, and please follow us on all of our social media pages.